This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for October 2009. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scherer, senior editor of the magazine. Each month on the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature a few poems and talk about an article in the upcoming issue.
This month, we're going to hear poetry from A.V. Christie.
Damn my father's smooth stone eyes.
Kevin Young.
He kept everything but alive.
And W.S. DiPiero.
Bad boys after keg night. Hungover.
We'll also speak with Richard Zenith about the great Portuguese modernist Fernando Pessoa.
Sincerity and truth for Pessoa don't really exist.
We have other work in the issue we'd like to mention first. Don, anything you want to highlight that particularly struck you?
Well, I was struck by a poem here by Kevin Prufer called In a Beautiful Country. I first heard it at a reading that Kevin gave, and it just stood out for me. And by the time I got back here, it had been submitted before Kevin gave the reading. And I was glad to see that poem again because I really wanted to encounter it again. It starts off, "A good way to fall in love is to turn off the headlights and drive very fast down dark roads." But it evolves into almost a political poem, and it's got some twists and turns in it, like the road that it describes.
It's a poem that conflates love poetry and war poetry to a certain extent, and then also the poetry just about self-destruction, because the poem goes through all different methods by which one might off himself, right?
Yeah, yeah. It sort of twists and turns around romance, you know, where at the end of the poem, a gold-haired girl, which sounds very idealized,
yeah,
says, "Don't worry about the armies. We live in a time full of love." And the poem ends, "You're thinking about this too much. Slow down. Nothing bad will happen."
We have a lot of book reviews, more than usual in this issue, and one of the standouts is Daisy Freed's review of Michael Hoffman, and regular readers of poetry and listeners to this podcast will know Michael Hoffman's work very well. He's been in our pages as a poet and also often as a reviewer and essayist and a translator. And she says he's fascinating, brilliant, and hard to write about. That's her first sentence, but then she does a great job of writing about that difficulty.
I would be intimidated by having to write about him, and I think she really carries this off well and just nails down a lot of what's going on in his fascinating work.
And we also have a poem in the issue by the late Craig Arnold, and many of our listeners may have already heard about how Craig Arnold vanished this past spring while climbing a volcano by himself in Japan. We have a poem in this issue by him, a wonderful poem, as well as a poem dedicated to him by his friend A.E. Stallings, and also an essay that I wrote. I knew Craig, and I wrote an editorial for this in remembrance of him. We spoke about Craig some in our podcast on Poetry Off the Shelf, and I encourage listeners to check that out.
There have been a number of tributes. One of the nice things we realized was that a lot of poets who knew Craig Arnold were in dialogue with him in their work and were able to represent that a little bit in this issue.
This month we feature three poems from A.V. Christie. Christie lives in Pennsylvania and teaches creative writing at universities in the Philadelphia area.
This is a dire poem.
The dire poem we're going to hear is called Forward, as in the opening remarks of a book.
Even though it's entitled Forward, it had its start by my own counting backward. And once I hit the month April, which I always think of as Eliot's month, the poem then began to settle, although I didn't know what it was going to do.
What it did do was lead Christie to an image from T.S. Eliot's most famous poem, The Wasteland. Not imagery in the usual sense exactly, but the editing marks that Ezra Pound made on Eliot's manuscript.
I have a book of the facsimile of The Wasteland, and you can see Pound's very heavy striking out, and I think that kind of drama and image was in my mind.
I have that book with the facsimile of The Wasteland in it, and one stanza that Pound very energetically crossed out was originally in the fire sermon section of the poem. It had the phrase, "the good old hearty female stench," and the scene is of a woman in a steaming perfumed bath.
The perfume and odors kind of confect her and but cannot hide or disguise this female stench.
Pound thought the phrase, and in fact the whole stanza, had to go, and Eliot agreed and took it out, but now it finds its way into Christie's poem, as you'll hear in just a minute.
I'd wanted something prettier in the poem, but that really struck me, sounded like something, unfortunately, my father would say, so that intensity really helped me figure out a way for the poem.
Here's A.V. Christie reading Forward.
I was conceived in the cruelest month in whatever spring California could muster. A little rain, with some more likely. and the Buckeyes were they yet on the ground? Damn my father's smooth stone eyes, other prevailing enticements, and what Eliot called the female stench. Damn the oaks, their histrionics, struggling in the fog. Spiderwebs lay in the grass, misted and looking like misspent galaxies. I cry into and out of this moment. Pound told Eliot, strike this and this. What was weak got dropped, and the poem stood stronger without it.
Well, of course, Eliot would have that phrase, the female stench. It's so psychologically revealing of Eliot.
Yeah, I like how she reclaims all this from him. And although the female stench part of the poem is pretty hefty there, there are other things here that are really nicely modulated that counterbalance it. So you have the Buckeyes and then her father's smooth stone eyes and the oaks and spiderwebs. And those expand into other things, the kind of histrionics and misspent galaxies.
Well, that incredible line, that's the moment in the poem for me, is that spiderwebs lay in the grass, misted and looking like misspent galaxies. That echoing sound and just that perfect, perfect comparison there.
Yeah, and I was just noticing the Buckeyes on the ground here as well. And that's very striking, the ending to me, now that I've actually visualized this in the real world. She says, what was weak got dropped, and the poem stood stronger without it, which is true of so many things, not just poems, and for that matter, not just trees dropping their chestnuts.
Yeah, and that's what I think you mean by reclaiming it, in that she mentions it's something her father might have said, and she says herself that that's unfortunate, but clearly she's taken that energy and made it a strength in this poem.
Yeah, and in that sense, maybe Eliot was a kind of father for her in her poems, too. Saying unfortunate things here and there.
Yeah. Kevin Young should be a familiar name to readers of Poetry Magazine, and he has a new poem in the October issue.
Young teaches writing at Emory University, where he's also the curator of the Donasky Poetry Library, which is this huge collection of all the wonderful little poetry books and big poetry books published over the last century or so. He now lives in Atlanta and Boston, but for a few years, he lived in San Francisco in the Mission District.
And that's where he gets the title for this meditation on sorrow. Here's Kevin Young reading The Mission.
Back there then, I lived across the street from a home for funerals. Afternoons, I'd look out the shades and think of the graveyard behind Emily Dickinson's house. How death was no concept, but soul after soul she watched pour into the cold New England ground. Maybe it was the sun of the mission. Maybe just being more young, but it was less disquiet than comfort. Days the street filled with cars for a wake. Children played tag out front while the bodies snuck in the back. The only hint of death, those clusters of cars, lights low as talk, idling dark as the second-hand suits that fathers or sons, now orphans, had rescued out of closets, praying they still fit. Most did. Most laughed despite themselves, shook hands, and grew hungry, out of habit, evening coming on again. The home's clock broke like a bone, always read 3. Mornings, or dead of night, I wondered who slept there, and wrote letters I later forgot I sent my father, now find buoyed up among the untidy tide of his belongings. He kept everything but alive. I have come to know sorrows not noun but verb, something that, unlike living by doing right, you do less of. The sun is too bright. Your eyes adjust, become like the night. Hands covering the face. Its numbers dark and unmoving, unlike the cars that fill and start to edge out, quiet cortege, crawling, half dim, till I could not see to see.
That last line comes from Emily Dickinson's famous poem, I Heard a Fly Buzz When I Died.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that we go from Emily Dickinson and the cold New England ground all the way out west to the Mission in San Francisco. It's sort of two hands embracing the whole continent of grieving.
You know, what Kevin is so good at is, first of all, using the line to convey multiple meanings, but also then to use words that open up in ways you don't expect. And if you look at the opening of this poem, it says, "Back there, then I lived." That's your first line. And it's a whole poem about dying, but and yet he was more alive.
Mm-hmm.
Across the street from a home for funerals. And so it's a home, and then suddenly the next line reveals, oh, but it's a home for funerals. I'd look out the shades. And of course, shades has a double meaning, and think of the graveyard. Even later he says, maybe just being more young. He doesn't say younger.
Yeah.
He says more young, as if it's more himself. You know,
pun on his name.
Right, that's Kevin all over right there. Yeah.
Well, one thing the poem doesn't do, which, you know, we're so used to seeing in poems about one's father or somebody dying, it doesn't reveal what he thinks of his father. It's as if he hasn't quite arrived at that yet or doesn't need to do it at this point. Though there's a bit in the middle there where the poem says about the father, he kept everything but alive. And it's kind of reminded me of that song, Papa Was a Rolling Stone. When he died, all he left us was alone.
Something
like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's an evasion, but it's not empty. In other words, there's feeling here, but it doesn't, you know, he doesn't feel obliged to disclose that feeling.
Interesting that also, I mean, Dickinson, ending with Dickinson is sort of the perfect place to end, because of course, you often can't tell in her poems what she's suffering. You can tell that she's suffering something, but not exactly what.
Yeah, it's a new way to look at Dickinson, I think, actually.
Unlike Kevin Young, W.S.D. Piero does currently live in San Francisco, but the poem we're about to hear is in fact set in Philadelphia.
Di Piero grew up in South Philadelphia in an Italian working-class neighborhood. He's also an art critic and essayist, and these things come together in his poem, The Ashbringer.
Though it's set in the present, it flashes on the past, and the past it flashes on is a time when the American artist Thomas Aikens, who lived and worked most of his adult life in Philadelphia, sketched and made a picture of Max Schmidt, an athlete who was famous for rowing.
The setting for The Ashbringer is a stretch of the Schuylkill River in Philadelphia.
It starts north of town and flows eventually into the Delaware. Where the Schuylkill and the Delaware come together is a place called League Island.
Here's W.S.D. Piero reading The Ashbringer.
A grainy pre-dawn dark, early expressway traffic, bleeding arterial taillights across gray water and its blue heart. Under Lemon Hill, grunts from Boathouse Row, woodshop clunks, young men's voices too loud for a day exhaling into starless skies. Bad boys after keg night, hungover, push long skulls into the water and slice its marcelled run. A marbled peacock wake behind each stroke, and coxswain counting that muscled steadiness past the waterworks, Spring Garden Street Bridge, then Girard Avenue Bridge, where on the bank Aikens sketches Max Schmidt in a single skull. His light like this, tinfoil blue, where the crews sweat off last night's lost time, but won't row too far north to river canals, Manayunk Reach, its towpath, mules and barges and anthracite from Point Carbon to feed stoves and bessemers in Harrisburg, Pittsburgh. Downriver, behind the boats and finny tracks, League Island, where cheats and pimply teens parked and tricked fingers through nipple hairs, satiny tufts, the shut-down Navy Yard, once staggering shore leave for so many thousands dead, how many more since, in the rivers, of the rivers, like the girl at a bend near the museum gazebo. She tips a throw of ashes from a brassy urn, kneeling, not pious, just there, slanting her head as if to speak to the passing. Do it right. Shrug fine oars into the river. It takes so long to cast away so little left of kin or friend to Schuylkill, Delaware, Chesapeake, Atlantic. Someone she knew, walked gardens with, and must have loved.
One of the things that DiPiero can do so well is he'll choose a word that you never would have expected, and it's like Keats in that way. It just opens up something like, push long skulls into the water and slice its marcelled run.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the hair, that image of the hair seems to prefigure that woman who comes in at the end, and the sound there is just perfect.
Push long skulls into the water and slice its marcelled run.
I think of the line by Wordsworth, we hissed along the polished ice in games, where it echoes the skates.
One of the things DiPiero does so well is recreating or creating sound in his poems, and usually in the poems of his that we've had in the magazine, you can hear sounds like buses and trains and jazz music. This one, though, is intensely, staggeringly visual, and the sounds of the lines actually create this kind of enormous painting like Aiken's.
Yeah, it is a painting like that. It's true.
And there's even eerie, haunting resonances here, so that Aiken's name appears in the poem, but towards the end, there's kind of a rhyme in it where the description is of someone casting away so little left of kin or friend.
He hates to be called painterly. He would slap us.
Well, I know, but they're not images as such. I mean, they're really made out of very deep textures of sounds, the sounds of the words
exactly.
And what's inherent in them. Yeah. So I think I'm off the hook a little there.
Well, that word throw is so amazing in this poem, a throw of ashes, because it's so unexpected. You know, it's like a throw of pain.
Or being in the throes of something.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's often used for childbirth. And
for or it to death, be, the throes of death.
Yeah, and for it to be right here is just perfect.
Yeah,
perfect.
It is.
Also in the October issue, we have a selection of notebook entries from the Portuguese poet Fernando Pessoa, translated by Richard Zenith.
Richard Zenith has done as much as anyone to bring Pessoa to the English-speaking world. He's translated several volumes of Pessoa's prose and poetry.
And he joins us by phone from his home in Lisbon. Hi, Richard.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. So, Richard, Fernando Pessoa's work is slowly but surely getting more attention in the U.S., and that's in no small part because of the translation that you've done. But I wonder if you could talk just a little bit about how he's viewed in Europe, where it seems like he's probably a much bigger deal.
Pessoa is really a household word, practically. His translations, particularly of the Book of Disquiet, sell in large numbers. And you talk to a cultured Frenchman or Italian, and they know immediately who Fernando Pessoa was.
I wonder why that is, that he doesn't have the same effect in the States.
He's catching on more and more. But it's been a much slower process also in the United Kingdom. So it's a harder market to break into.
Right.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, Pessoa means person in Portuguese. Is that right?
Yes, that is right, yeah.
That's too good a name for a poet who seems not to have believed in an individual self or in personality. Would you say that something about this is the main theme in all his writing?
Indeed. And Pessoa felt that nothing was quite by chance. Pessoa had a rather mystical view of the world. He felt that everything was symbols and that there was another plane of existence. I don't know how much he really believed that, because in some ways he seemed to have believed in nothing at all. But at any rate, he lived as if he believed it. And so I think the fact that his last name meant person for him was a significant fact and had meaning that he grabbed onto and ran with. And made himself into, as we know, many persons.
I wonder if you could talk just a little bit about the piece that you translated. It's titled From a Notebook That Never Was. Why does it have that title, first of all?
Well, that's a title that I invented, because Pessoa, although he did have a number of notebooks, they weren't really the literary kind of notebook where he sticks to one kind of a theme. His notebooks, as really in all his writing, were potpourri. They had everything, and they had his private life and mixed in with his public life and very mundane things such as lists of what he needed to buy or bills that he needed to pay off, mixed in with some sublime verses of poetry or bits of prose. But he was always writing, among other things, these reflections about life and himself, and they pop up everywhere. So I pulled some of these together, things that had not been translated, as things that might appear in a literary sort of notebook if he'd kept one.
Here's a bit from one entry that you translated. In its essence, life is monotonous. Happiness, therefore, depends on a reasonably thorough adaptation to life's monotony. By making ourselves monotonous, we make ourselves equal to life. Thus, we live to the full. And living to the full is to be happy. He starts with a perfectly plausible proposition here, and then he explores its logical but often outrageous implications. And does he do this in his poems as well?
He does. And he's very tongue-in-cheek, and he's very self-critical. So he would never, in one way he would defend for himself a monotonous existence. That is, his outer life was somewhat monotonous. He never married. He had one fleeting romantic relationship that was probably not consummated. And this allowed him to have a very active inner life where all kinds of things were happening in his imagination. He was very contradictory, too. He liked to take everything out logically as far as he could, and he would arrive at these absurd conclusions sometimes that he didn't necessarily take seriously.
Well, speaking of contradictions, one of the sentences in the piece in this issue says, "No superior man deigns to grant other people's opinion such importance that he'd bother to contradict it." Do you have trouble knowing when Pessoa is being sincere, when he really means what he's saying, or is looking for sincerity, missing the point of what he's up to in his writing?
Well, Pessoa was very aware that there is no truth with a capital T. There's only relative truth. And also that there's no stable, coherent, cogent I. That we're a mess of conflicting sensations and thoughts and feelings, and we our conscious kind of packages part of that into a sense of the I. And so sincerity and truth for Pessoa don't really exist. Everything for Pessoa is, in a way, construction. We're always making ourselves.
Well, thanks so much for talking to us today, Richard.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been my pleasure.
You can read Richard Zenith's translations of Fernando Pessoa's piece From a Notebook That Never Was and everything else you've heard on this program in the October issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman, edited by Sarah Campbell, and produced by Curtis Fox Productions.
The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scherer.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.